Stephen, thank you very much indeed for your kind introduction. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for inviting me here today. It's a pleasure to be here and to be able to discuss with you issues of criminal justice reform. I have what I think is probably a unique vantage point to be able to do so. Since the new government was formed, I have been a minister in both the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice. This is a very unusual position. Most ministers obviously only have a job in one ministry. I often make the point that I am one minister, two jobs, no salary, no car, and only one salary. I therefore work both with Theresa May and with Ken Clark. And I have a day-to-day responsibility for policing because I am the minister for the police, but I also have an overarching responsibility for criminal justice reform. And I therefore do look at the programmes not just of policing reform that I want to talk about in the Home Office, but of sentencing and penal reform that are being driven by the Ministry of Justice. Of course, we all understand the reasons why the previous government split the Home Office and felt that it was important that that department should have a tighter focus on what you might call the homeland security issues of dealing with terrorism, immigration, security and policing, leaving criminal justice policy and penal policy, previously the responsibility of the Home Office, to be the responsibility of the new department. We took some time in opposition to consider whether that was the right move. I believe the jury is still out on it, because there is always the danger of a dislocation of criminal justice policy. Part of my job is to try and ensure that that is not the case. I stand here against a very obvious economic background that is permeating everything that the coalition government is doing at the moment. And that is that we need to deal with a budget deficit and control public spending. Of course, there is a political debate about the extent to which the deficit should be reduced, but the fact is that there is cross-party agreement that it should be reduced. The only disagreement is about how much and how fast. And what that means is that under any government now, it would be necessary to reduce spending on our criminal justice system. Indeed, we know that the criminal justice system both has record levels of spending on it, approaching £20 billion a year, and is one of the most expensive systems in the world. Faced with difficult choices, both the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice have announced big reductions in spending, both on policing budgets and on the prisons budget, and on the wider justice budget as a whole, in order to play their part in reducing spending overall and contributing to the reduction in the deficit. And such reductions come after a period of considerable expansion in relation to spending in the criminal justice sector, both in policing, where we've seen a very significant increase in inputs, with an expansion in the size of police forces, not just of police officers, but of staff, and in relation to prison spending, where, of course, there has been, for some time, an increase in the prison population, such that today, prison population is broadly at record levels. So here is the challenge. How do you continue to ensure that crime is fought effectively, that justice is delivered, and that people are kept safe at a time where you need to reduce spending on these key services. I put aside any suggestion that what you do is not reduce spending on these services, because I'm going to take it as read, as I said, that any government would find itself in the position where it had to. And what I think this argues for is something that, even if we weren't confronted with such difficult budgetary decisions, we should be considering, and that is the need for radical reform in the criminal justice sector. Indeed, in opposition, I had worked on reform proposals both for policing and for prisons before the economic downturn and the financial crisis took hold in this country, before it became essential to consider how spending was going to be reduced. And so the reforms that the coalition government is seeking to introduce are by no means driven solely because of the need to save money, although I believe that driving efficiency, securing value for money should always be an objective in the delivery of public services. Let me start off first with the policy proposals that I worked on first, which were in relation to policing. For some time, the debates which we have had in our British politics, inside Parliament and out, has centred on a purely inputs-driven approach. The test of political virility when it came to pledges on policing was how many police officers you could pledge. And all parties were caught up in this. And what I think was missed in this was what the real questions were, which was how effectively policing was delivered, how effectively those inputs were being used, and what the outcomes were in relation to policing. What was the relationship between the police and the public? And I think it is important to understand that the principles that we are applying to reforms in both policing and in the penal sector are principles that are common to the approach that we're taking to public services as a whole. They are a belief that what matters is outcomes, that the growth in central government intervention brought with it a costly compliance and a diminution in the trust and role of professionals and the exercise of their discretion, that the growth of the target culture was both distorting of performance in the public sector and particularly demoralising for those that worked in it. I need to say that these levers, which were introduced and accelerated by the previous government under the philosophy which is sometimes described as deliverology, were introduced for benign, not malign, reasons. The previous government wanted to improve standards in public services. That was a noble aim. They were increasing spending, or what they called investment in public services, very fast, and they wished to ensure the improvements in performance to match. The chosen route was to grip public services ever harder. The idea of central grip wasn't new. It had been pioneered, really, by the previous Conservative government. You could see it in the education reforms which had first seen the introduction of things like the national curriculum. But the approach was, as I say, accelerated considerably by the government that followed. If you were a police officer working then in the system, you would certainly have found that ever more money was being spent in your force. If you were working in the arena of criminal justice, you may have felt less that ever more money was being spent, partly because the resource was being taken up in the expansion in the number of prison places. But what you also felt was a very close prescription about how you did your job. Indeed, the previous government got to the point where it published a policing pledge that was very specific about how police officers should act, to the point where it told them how to answer phones and the time that they should take in doing so. When I arrived as a minister at the Home Office, I found that there was a sign outside the loos on my floor, which injuncted me not just to wash my hands, but told me how to wash my hands. And that indeed was the prevailing philosophy that there was in the department, that the job of central government, in order to lever up standards, was to be very prescriptive about how public services should be delivered. Our approach then was to say that actually this was not going to secure the outcomes that were needed. Firstly, as I mentioned, there was very costly compliance associated with such an approach. The introduction of targets brought with it a great box-ticking, form-filling bureaucracy. The second effect was that it was very demoralising to those who worked in the public sector because they weren't being trusted as professionals, but they had, looking over their shoulder, a whole army of other people who were checking that they did the job correctly. And the third thing that we observed was that it didn't necessarily produce the enhanced outcomes that we wanted in the first place. What it could do was produce distortions and behaviour so that the targets could be met. In policing, not very far from here, at Lancing, there was a famous example of how targets could distort priorities in a public service. For a time, there was a target of bringing offences to justice. Some of you will remember that. It seemed a sensible idea to the government at the time. The Prime Minister then, Tony Blair, was concerned that detection rates were too low in policing. He thought that the way to deal with that was to set targets to police forces to bring more offences to justice. So police forces and police officers found novel ways to do so. In this particular case, a police officer came across a body hanging from a tree. In the pocket of this corpse, the police officer found a penknife and duly attempted to record an offence of the possession of a dangerous weapon. I think most of you, being erudite students in this university, will have spotted that that particular corpse posed no risk to others for having a penknife in its pocket. To be fair, the sergeant intercepted that attempt to record the offence in that way and prevented it from happening. But the very fact that the officer was motivated to do so shows the distorting effect that targets could bring. When we came to office, we felt that there needed to be a new way to deliver public sector improvements. That we should sweep away the paraphernalia of targets that had produced the bureaucracy and the distortions and the demoralisation. And that instead, what government should be interested in is not how public services were doing their job, but what the outcomes were. That the role of government should be different. And that actually, public sector professionals themselves were much more likely to know how to deliver better policing or how to secure an intervention that will prevent an offender from reoffending and so on than any minister sitting in Whitehall or any Whitehall bureaucrat would be likely to know. All well and good. How then are we to ensure that the same objective which the previous government had, which is to secure performance in return for the investment that is being made, can be delivered without that apparatus of central targetry? And particularly at a time when far from expanding the resource that these public services were being delivered, actually they were having to deal with reduced budgets year on year. And what that argued for was a fundamentally different approach. So in policing, we started to look again, not at the numbers of people that were working in police forces, but actually in how those people were being deployed. And we started to apply a set of principles that you will see being applied across the public sector. Where do the incentives lie for better performance? If we want to ensure that crime is fought effectively on the ground, who is incentivized to make sure that that is the case? And who will be held accountable for ensuring that it is the case? If government's role is to be interested in the outcome, if it is to supply the lion's share of the money, if it is to set the overall framework of laws to ensure that things are done properly, who actually is going to be accountable for securing that better performance? Because what we can't do is simply cut public services loose. The idea of reducing targetry and central intervention can never be a reason just to hand over public services to the professionals who work in them and say, there you are, you get on with it. Because, of course, that is a remedy, a recipe for producer capture. And that is something we need to avoid in public services, and I want to come to that at the end. So we have to ask the questions about where the incentives lie and where the accountabilities lie. In policing, one of the concerns we had was that if we reduced all of the central intervention, as we have done, that we would need to ensure that police forces answered for their performance, that somebody would be assessing how well they were doing. Of course, the ultimate measure in policing has to be the levels of crime. But that's why we reached the view that the local accountability of policing had to be strengthened, and that's why we have sought to replace police authorities with directly elected police and crime commissioners to give the public a greater voice. Not, I may say, to interfere in the operational decisions which police officers must make. No politician should ever direct a police officer to make an arrest or to pursue an investigation or to stop an investigation. Those are operational matters that have always been for impartial police officers accountable to the law to decide. But in the end, a politician somewhere has to decide how much money policing is going to have. Somewhere there has to be a voice for the public in setting the overall strategic priorities for a force. And we have sought to strengthen that public voice at the local level. Here in Sussex, there is a police authority for the force, which covers both East and West Sussex, and of course, Brighton. I wonder if anybody here knows who the members of the authority are. Some of you may be members, and I mean no disrespect in asking that question. But of course, it is mostly the case that residents in Sussex do not know who the chair of their authority is or who the members are. They're not meant to. The authority isn't meant to be a body that is so visible or connected to the public. It was designed not to be. It includes independent members and so on. But it means that the public have less of a connection to those who hold the force to account than they do, for instance, in London, where they elect a mayor and the mayor has responsibility for the Met. And when things go wrong, or if the public want things to be done in a different way, they know who to go to. The current mayor in London stood on a platform of wanting to deal with knife crime, of wanting to ensure that there was a uniformed presence on public transport and to deal with that form of antisocial behaviour that you could see on public transport. And now, as an accountable individual, his feet are held to the fire in the delivery of those promises. That connection which the public have with the mayor in London, because they put him there, is broadly popular with Londoners, even though there are millions of Londoners, even though it is a large and diverse community. That direct connection has been one that I think most people would not wish to see reversed, such that London's policing would now be held to account by an invisible committee of appointees. Indeed, I think if you suggested that, that the responsibility from the mayor should be taken away, it would be very unpopular because it would be to deny the public a voice. It is that principle of direct accountability that we seek to introduce in the rest of the forces in England and Wales, and the first elections are going to happen in November the next year. So that's one element which I think is particularly important in relation to how you will drive better performance in a reform system, and that is the enhancement of accountability for public services. The second element I have already referred to, which is making sure that you get the incentives right. Because no system, no behaviour will change unless actually somebody is properly incentivised to change it. Get the incentives wrong and you will get the distortions in performance, of course, that I have described in relation to targets. I think this is best illustrated by taking the second element of reform in the criminal justice system, that relating to penal reform, and looking at how we are seeking to apply the same principles of accountability and alignment of incentives there. Because when we started to examine why it is that reoffending rates are so high, why it is that we have a penal system that processes offenders, ultimately where the prolific offenders find themselves incarcerated, are released but then reoffend at very high rates. You all know the figures and I don't need to repeat them. The question we had to ask is whether simply an approach that was inputs-led, that would be about spending more money, doing more of the same, would be likely to succeed in reducing those reoffending rates, or whether in fact there wasn't a deeper problem, a problem both of accountability and of incentives. Because the real issue in our penal system is who is accountable for making sure that those offenders don't reoffend again. Is there a single point of accountability? The answer is no. Where do the incentives lie in the system to make sure that offenders don't reoffend again? If you follow the path of a prolific offender from the point where they first enter the criminal justice system and are given a low-level disposal, perhaps a discretionary one on the part of a police officer, to where they then become under the purview of a magistrate, are put on a community sentence, repeatedly offend, then find their way into prison, are then released from prison. There are many points of inflection, many points at which the system is interacting with those offenders. But at no point does any single institution, any body, have the responsibility that says, we are going to stop that person reoffending. While they are in prison, the principal mission of those who are holding them in their incarcerated condition is to make sure that they are safe, that they do not harm themselves or each other, and of course that they do not escape. There is very little that is done by way of interventions to help reduce reoffending or address offending behaviour for short-term prisoners. There is no statutory supervision or support for short-term offenders on their release from prison. And so the cycle of offending is perpetuated. So to those who were telling us, even before the economic downturn, that the solution to rapidly rising rates of incarceration of prisoners and high reoffending rates was to spend more public money, we questioned whether that would actually have the effect, when actually there seemed to be a systemic problem there, that there was no proper accountability and no single set of incentives that would actually argue for a better or allow a better response for those offenders. Something else was lacking too, and this applies across the criminal justice system, and this is the third principle of reform, and that is an almost complete absence of transparency. The criminal justice system is very opaque. There is a lack of information about what is happening that makes it very difficult to hold it to account, even if the systems of accountability within it were better, and they are not. Part of the government's reform agenda is to drive an incredibly ambitious and radical programme of transparency across our public services, and the criminal justice system has certainly been included within that. And this isn't an end for its own sake. It is a very important part of the new system whereby public services are to be held to account, because you simply cannot do so unless you have the information which is going to tell you how well the systems are performing. You can't just, I think, rely on the outcomes, on the reoffending rates and the levels of crime, because you need to know actually who was responsible for producing them. And to do that, you need to have the information. Until now, and we are changing this, it was not possible to obtain the rates of reoffending that each prison was presiding over. So it wasn't possible to measure how effective each prison was in reducing reoffending, because that information simply was not published. Very little information is published by courts in relation to the sentences that they hand down. The list actually goes on. You will have seen, I expect, one of the most shining examples of how we are introducing this principle of transparency in the system. And that is the introduction of street-level crime mapping on the website police.uk. You are likely to have seen it because it has, since its launch at the beginning of this year, received 430 million hits. No government website has ever received so much traffic. That is, of course, hits, not individual visits. But even if you were to scale down that level of traffic and work it out in terms of the number of visits, you would still be talking about the tens of millions of visits. Quite staggering interest. It's not surprising. People want to know about crime that's committed in their area, and a facility that actually enables them to know exactly what crimes were committed and where on their street is of intense interest to people, both in terms of their own safety, the wider safety of their neighbourhood, their safety of their children as they go off to school, their own safety in coming back home, if they're wanting to sell their house or buy a house somewhere else. Of course, we all want to know about the levels of crime in their area. But of course, you can see just how powerful such a tool is when that information is put in the hands of the public. Because now the public had the ability to hold the police to account, not by the use of some abstract statistic on how the force is doing. We've all got very used to public services publishing bulletins telling us how well they've done by comparison to the previous year. In such and such a an area, we are reducing burglaries by this much and so on. Some of this data is not only indigestible, but may not be relevant to your street, or indeed it may simply be it produced in a form that is meaningless. Such data, by the way, is distrusted as well by the public. Street-level crime information is real, and it's constantly updated, and it's going to improve. Tomorrow, we are updating the crime categories on the site, and by going through that portal, you will actually be able to compare the performance of your police force compared to others. Next year, we are introducing justice outcomes on the site too, so that you will not only be able to see what crime is committed on your street, but what happened when it was committed. Was it how was it dealt with, and how did the system deal with it? This information, as I say, is not provided for its own sake, but because this is the means by which the public can hold public services to account. And you see then a different kind of intervention and a different kind of power. One that I think is much more effective than the idea that the way we were going to drive better police performance was by directing and gripping from the centre. Because now the people in the driving seat are the public at the very local level. This website isn't a negative one. It also shows the pictures of neighbourhood policing teams. It gives their information. It allows neighborhood policing teams to publish information to the users that is relevant to them when they've typed in their postcodes. And so it helps to build a bridge between the police and the public. Police cannot fight crime alone. We need to build that compact between the police and citizens. So Robert Peel, the founder of Modern Policing, said the police are the public and the public are the police. But it does put an incredibly powerful lever in the hands of the public to drive better performance. Not by writing to their Member of Parliament, not by throwing things at the television, not by sending an email to Downing Street, but by being able to get hold of their local police officers and asking what they intend to do about something. And in turn, their local police officers being able to say to them, other people are concerned, will you help form a group so that we can keep an eye on this neighbourhood and so on. By these means, by securing greater accountability and transparency, by getting the incentives right, we are, in my view, effecting a revolution in the way that public services will be delivered and held to account, and we will be driving a far greater involvement on the part of the public than we have seen before. And that involvement is important too, because the opacity of the criminal justice system that I described has had another effect, which is that it has been a system that has privileged professionals. It is one which you can argue actually is owned by those who work in particular the criminal justice professionals and the lawyers and others. Talk to any victim of crime and their experience of the criminal justice system, and you will find that is what they say. If we publish more information about our public services, and if we think of new ways that actually make a reality of the often quoted mantra that we should be putting victims at the heart of the criminal justice system, we can turn that on its head and build a system which actually privileges the public and not the professionals. Let me give you one example of that. Terrible things happened during the riots. We all know that. But from the riots, good things sprang. One of them was the incredible civic activism that we saw in response. Communities coming together, people helping each other, helping the police, helping themselves. There's been a huge increase in the number of applications for special constables, the volunteers that support policing in response to the riots. Another good thing that came out of the response to the riots was the operation of the criminal justice system. Because cases that usually take weeks or months to complete, the average duration of a case in a magistrate's court is something like 150 days between when the offence is committed and final disposal, were actually being completed in hours and days. Offenders were being brought before courts very quickly. Justice was being dispensed far more quickly than normal. And one of the things that does, of course, is hugely enhance the victim experience of the criminal justice system. I can't, from memory, remember the statistic about the number of cases that are heard in a magistrate's court on the day that was originally set, but it is a minority. Most cases in a magistrate's court are not heard on the day that they are set. A new date is set for them. Can you imagine if an airline was run on the same basis? And so what we have seen in response to the riots is a criminal justice system that was operating to a different set of standards and a different ambition. And one of the things that I believe we can do is normalise that performance. Not for every case, of course. And it's true that the contested cases are taking longer in response to the riots. But if we set a higher ambition for the system, where we say that actually we should expect that people are brought before the courts more quickly, we should expect that we are not messing victims around and that cases are heard when they are meant to be, then I think that not only are we delivering swift and more sure justice, which should be an ambition, we are also enhancing the experience for victims and building public confidence as well. New technology will enable this better performance. We've seen the growth of video links in courts, for instance. We are digitalizing the criminal justice system now such that next year documents will be exchanged between the criminal justice agencies by digital transfer rather than in huge paper copies. You may raise your eyebrows and wonder why this is so revolutionary. I can assure you in the criminal justice system it is. And indeed at a conference where I announced that this really should happen and that the rest of the world was using digital transfer and email and so on, and so could we. One lawyer stood up and said, what will happen if the technology breaks down and as a result a case is held up? Seemed to me to be wonderfully oblivious to what happens at the moment, because files aren't produced, files go missing, lawyers don't turn up, police officers are in the wrong place. There are all sorts of things that happen at the moment in the system that we are running that mean that justice is not swift and sure, and the idea that technology will be an obstacle to improvement rather than a facilitator of improvement strikes me as being an extraordinary one. But the reason I mention this criminal justice efficiency agenda is not because I believe it is a diversion, but because I believe it is, again, a very important application of the principle that we should be reforming systems in the public interest and not in the producer interest. Before I leave these principles of reform that I was seeking to set out, those of greater accountability, transparency and incentives, I want to return briefly to the area of prisons reform, which I think is so important. I mentioned that I thought one of the problems in relation to our prisons was the issue of who was incentivized and accountable to ensure that there were reductions of reoffending. I don't want to do that without telling you about the solution which we are working towards to introduce that level of accountability and incentives. In our welfare programmes, you will know that there is a really interesting, radical and innovative proposal that is being introduced in order to encourage people back into work. And that is the idea of payment by results. It is really quite a simple principle that it is cheaper for the state to fund an organisation that can successfully take somebody off benefit and put them into work than it is to pay the benefit in the first place. So we can apply that principle to criminal justice and introduce the idea of paying by results to providers who will help us reduce reoffending. And by doing that, we can make sure that there is accountability and that the incentives are right. Because essentially what we are saying to the public sector, to prisons, to a private sector prison, to a third sector provider, if you can succeed in reducing reoffending, we will pay you a success fee. And it will then be up to them to decide what the best means of reducing offending is. To those who question this principle, who think that it's some kind of awful marketization in our criminal justice system, I would say that the idea of justice reinvestment has been around for some time and has constantly been urged on political parties. That is encapsulated in by the notion that really we need to persuade governments to spend more money earlier on because that will prevent costs downstream. And of course there is some kind of intuitive truth in that. If we stop offenders going off the rails at an early stage, we stop them getting into that cycle of crime. We know that over half of all reoffending, of all offending is committed by those who have committed crime before. The costs of incarcerating prisoners are very high. The costs of reoffending run into the billions of pounds a year. Surely it must make sense to have effective interventions earlier on rather than spend that money downstream. And it does. But no Treasury will ever be suckered into that straightforward proposition that all they have to do is spend more money up front and somehow magically a saving will appear at the end. You and I would not be similarly suckered by such a proposition. Because the question we would ask is, what are you actually doing to make sure that the system will work if we spend more money on it at the front end and that actually that reoffending will be reduced? Or are we going to end up with not one bill but two? More money spent at the front and a rising bill at the end as well. That is what payment by results will help us to address. Because actually, if we say that there is an intervention that we can make that will only be funded if it succeeds, then we have a chance to make sure that there is accountability in the system. This is a world first. We pioneered this idea and other countries are interested in it, and it's already happening. We have pilot schemes now running in a couple of prisons, and there are going to be more, which will pay by results and introduce those reductions in reoffending. Let me end by saying this. Whether it is our reforms to policing to introduce greater accountability and to incentivize professionals, whether it is our reforms in relation to penal policy, and I haven't talked about our reforms in relation to community sentencing, which I can, if you like, in questions. The driving concern should be to ensure an efficient and effective system that enhances public confidence, delivers public safety, and ensures justice. The driving concern is not to reduce public spending, though that is a necessity. But we do need to take a step back and ask ourselves why it is that the criminal justice system is unlike any public service, is a system where public interaction with it actually results in confidence in it going down, not up. Other public services where there is an interaction with it results in approval ratings going up. The health service is a very good example. People's experience of the health service, usually, of course, we have some notable exceptions at the moment, usually means, and the surveys bear this out, that they have a higher estimation of it, having experienced of it, than they had before. In the criminal justice system, the opposite is true. Confidence ratings in policing have been improving. Let me say straight away, they are a whole lot better in terms of approval rating than they would be for members of parliament. But it is still the case that a full third of those who come into contact with the police are dissatisfied with the performance and the experience that they receive. And I'm not talking at all, actually, about criminals who, of course, may not have an experience that they wish to have when the police intercept them. I'm talking about members of the public. So as well as being concerned about the outcomes, as well as being ensuring that we deliver a safer society and reductions in crime, we also need to ensure that we have a system in which the public have greater confidence. And I think that is an incredibly important part of the agenda of criminal justice reform that we seek to promote. I think it comes by being serious about introducing the transparency and accountability that I describe, but it also comes as a result of being innovative about the ways in which we can engage the public in the operation of the system. Whether it is through the ideas that I described as street-level crime mapping, whether it is through the new ideas of things like neighbourhood justice and restorative justice, which will involve the public in helping offenders to make amends and go straight, whether it is the engagement of the public through third sector or organisations that help to deal with offenders, I do not believe that the criminal justice system can be one which is divorced from the public or is oblivious to the interests of those who experience it, and in particular the victims of crime who have to engage with it. Because, of course, there are a very great number of those, because there are something like 8 million crimes committed a year. I am very optimistic, in spite of the challenging economic climate, about what we can achieve here. There is no doubt that we are having to take difficult decisions. Reducing spending on the police means that the overall size of police workforces is coming down. Although I should say that the impact on the front line can be mitigated by the right decisions being taken about driving savings elsewhere. For those that work in the public sector, things like a two-year pay freeze, changes to pensions, the fact that jobs are going, makes, of course, for a difficult environment. And we understand that. I go back to what I said about decisions having to be taken. But in terms of the destination, once we get through the downturn and the reform programs begin to yield results. I believe that setting up public services in a way where professionals are trusted, where there is accountability, but more freedom and innovation and discretion as to how professionals can do their jobs, where public services are valued by the public and have a closer engagement with the public, is a good destination. And that's why I'm optimistic about the changes that we are making. It is a privilege for me to be working in the two departments that are driving some of the most radical parts of our public sector reform that this government is seeing. The others, of course, relate to education policy particularly and to welfare policy. It is also a considerable challenge. In the end, I can't do anything without the engagement and the support of those that work in these services, whether they are policing professionals, probation professionals, prison officers. It is the people in our public services who make them work, and it is the people who will deliver the services in the future. And it's important that we value those people. Thank you for inviting me here today to describe this agenda, to describe thematically the criminal justice reforms that we seek to make. And I'm very happy now to answer any questions that you may have about what I've said or other aspects of policy that I may not have covered. Thank you.